Not too long ago on the show, I talked about that feeling that takes hold of me every September, that the year is starting all over again, and now's the time to actually get down to business. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I think most of us have had that feeling already this month, but yes, really, this week is when that getting down to business thing happens in the presidential race. Finally. The first debate is Monday, and this past week brought us real and painful reminders of the tough things we have to talk about as a country. We're going to get into them in this show. Plus, we revisit Flint, Michigan, with the superintendent of schools there. No, they still can't drink the water, and no, they don't know when that's going to end. As always, come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. We are starting off the show, as we often do, with our segment Long and Short. That's when we look at the news using the language of finance. Long, as in betting on something. Short, as in betting against it. And this week, we have The Atlantic's senior associate editor, Jillian White, and Marketplace's DC Bureau chief, Andrea Seabrook. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much.
Andrea, since we are on the verge of the first presidential debate, really, finally, in this cycle, I guess I'm going to start with you. Go ahead and tee up your long for us.
I am going long on the debate, and not just because we expect 100 million people to watch this live. You know, that's like Super Bowl levels of live show on TV. But because there are big things that have happened in the past week that really renew our focus on what these candidates say and energize, you know, the two main party candidates' bases in a way that I think will make this debate really different. We have improvised explosive devices, you know, with pressure cookers and, you know, pipe bombs planted around the New York City area, New York, New Jersey. And that has really, like, played to the people who support Donald Trump and want much, much more robust security measures in place. And then you have the two more shootings of Black men at the hands of police and massive protests, in some cases turning violent in Charlotte, which energizes the people who are supporting Hillary Clinton. So this debate, while a week ago we thought we knew what it was going to be about, will we achieve prosperity and all of these sort of things that the networks lined up, this is going to be the show to watch.
I am totally with you on that. I'm super interested to see how much these events are talked about and in what context. I think you're totally right. We can't have a conversation about economic prosperity without having a conversation about quality and, in some cases, just a base level of preservation of life.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people in America who feel unsafe. And I'm using that word because I think if you want to be a serious candidate for the presidency of the United States, you have to get up and talk about this stuff. And I hope that I can go long on debate moderators. I would like to think that the pretty impressive group of journalists who are going to run these things really put the candidates through their paces, because we are at such a what can feel like a fragile moment. And I think it's really important to hear about these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jillian, why don't you tell me about your long, which I guess is really right down the center of the marketplace coverage area.
Yeah, so I am long on accountability for bank CEOs. you know, we have all heard a ton about the scam that Wells Fargo was pulling for years, opening up fake accounts. And while it seems like the head of that division is going to get canned and get a pretty nice golden parachute, there doesn't seem to be a ton of accountability from the actual CEO of Wells Fargo.
Yeah, why are you long on accountability? John Stumpf doesn't seem like he's going anywhere.
Well, so I am long on accountability only because this is a hopeful long, right? So one, Elizabeth Warren got out there and really put him through his paces, as you said, and kind of lost it on him and said, you should resign. And while I don't think that the accountability will go as far as the DOJ investigation, I'm not that hopeful. I am hopeful that bringing this to light and showing people just how pervasive these types of scandals are and people being fed up about the lack of accountability coming out of the crisis, that perhaps there will be enough public sentiment to finally just push him out.
I have raised eyebrows 2 year long, but okay.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair. I understand this is a very optimistic long, but I'm going to hold on to it. I'm going to double down on it.
All right. Well, I feel like, Andrea, your short kind of knits into Jillian's long a little bit if we're talking about accountability or lack thereof.
Yeah, I'm short in Congress here. You can never go wrong in some ways shorting Congress, but so it's kind of a safe bet. But, you know, Congress, with all of its, you know, fire and brimstone and ideology, and we're going to hold people to account and, you know, make things right and blah, 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 blah. They are doing everything they can to get the heck out of Washington, D.C. so they can go home and campaign in their districts. There was a looming question of shutdown and wanting to close off the budget for the year and all these sort of questions of ideology floating around in the Capitol. No more, my friend. The Senate passed overwhelmingly a piece of legislation which has almost nothing in it, just as a vehicle for another to fund the government when they figure out that package so they can get out of town. This is all about saving their jobs.
We could short Congress probably every week of the last how many years?
Yeah, this is a very dependable short. Jillian, why don't you give us your short?
Yeah, so my short is on employee dress codes that single out groups of people. So this week, an appeals court upheld a ruling that an insurance company terminating an employee or a would-be employee after she refused to cut her dreadlocks, they said it was not discrimination. And the suit was filed by the EEOC, which is the group that's responsible for making sure that discrimination like this or discrimination in general does not happen in workplaces. And essentially, the court said that this is not discrimination because despite the fact that dreadlocks are predominantly found among the African-American community and have a lot of roots there, that it is what they call a mutable characteristic, which means that it is something that can be changed. Essentially, they're saying you could just shave your head, so this isn't discrimination. And I think the reason that I am short this is because I am, again, hopeful that we are in a space where we realize that stereotyping groups of people and their hairstyles and their natural hair and the way they look as being unprofessional is, you know, on the way out. And I think a lot of people were upset about it and a lot of people were enraged by it. And I think that they are well within their right to be.
Well, this is such an interesting thing, this mutable, immutable phrase, which is where the decision turned. And I guess I wonder, from a legal standpoint, does this case have the legs to go any further?
I'm not hearing a ton about it being able to go much further legally. I think that the bigger issue, though, is in the consistency around the types of employee dress codes that we see, right? So they so often, I feel, target groups of people who are already vulnerable and already have like all of these stereotypes assigned to them. So they target women and say that you can't dress a certain way lest you be provocative or lest you incite some type of speech or something else. They target minorities. They target people of a certain religion. And they say, can't be yourself in the workplace. And there are some small stipulations that, you know, can help people get around that. But, you know, saying to somebody who has grown dreadlocks for either moral reasons or cultural reasons or personal reasons for years, hey, you can just go shave your head, feels a little nuts to me. It feels a little unfair.
And you're short this because you think that the publicity around this case is going to change things?
Yeah, I'm short this because I'm hopeful that the publicity around this and the conversation around this will help people kind of look at their employee-based dress codes and say, is this an actual fair thing? Is there a reason that this is in here?
Jillian White from The Atlantic, Andrea Seabrook from Marketplace, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We mentioned the homemade bombs behind the investigation in New York and New Jersey this week. At least one was made from a pressure cooker, as were the bombs at the Boston Marathon in 2013. So here's the thing. If you can make a bomb from stuff that just about any of us can buy at the store, how should we treat those items? Like a registry for pressure cookers? How would you even do that? Sally Herships has the story.
The materials you can use to make a bomb can be so mundane, it can seem almost surreal.
You know, I was involved in discussions a long time ago about pie tins.
So, wow, pie tins.
I know. It was one of the weirder moments of my government career.
Now, James Lewis is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But he used to work with the Department of State and says, yeah, you can use pie tins to make a bomb.
You know, some people said, gee, we ought to find a way to control pie tins. And it's like, get a grip.
He says if the government started tracking pressure cookers, terrorists would just find something else.
Pursuing everything that could be used to do harm is just a fruitless task.
Instead of law enforcement tracking our pots and pans, Lewis says we should keep an eye on people, the ones who make bombs, potentially including surveilling our communications. But if we really wanted to track the sale of pressure cookers, we could.
Certainly technically possible.
William Banks is director of the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism at Syracuse University. He says, look no farther than fertilizer and think back to Oklahoma City, 1995. Before that, fertilizer was something we thought of for farmers to grow more crops. Then it was used in a massive bombing that killed 168 people.
After the Oklahoma City bombings, we decided to tag and then monitor the sale and use of many of those materials. We could do that again.
Except Banks says we shouldn't. For consumers, being watched while shopping would mean privacy issues. And for everyone else, it would mean a lot of extra work.
You know, retailers and wholesalers would say, oh my God, you know, every time I sell a pressure cooker now, I've got to fill out a piece of paper.
At a colorful Brooklyn houseware store, which sells a couple of models of pressure cookers, Pri Ferdi is shopping for a salad bowl. She says watching what we buy isn't enough anyway.
People need to know that extremism is just not about a pressure cooker. It's about why that person bought a pressure cooker to begin with.
Luckily, most of the time, it's because they just want to make stew. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Being Marketplace, we are kind of dominated by the numbers in the news. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills with some of this week's news by the numbers. All right, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
500 million.
That's how many accounts were compromised in a massive hack at Yahoo, the company confirmed this week.
The data breach could include names, emails, phone numbers, and more, but no payment info.
Yahoo said, quote, a state-sponsored actor was responsible for the hack, which happened back in late 2014.
1,000.
That's how many families migrate from Puerto Rico to Florida every month.
They're fleeing humanitarian and economic strife in the territory, although the housing and jobs they find stateside might not be much better.
One town in central Florida has grown by 20% in the past 6 years because of the migration, and some families are forced to stay in motel rooms and take jobs well below their level of education.
8.1%.
That's how much revenue rose in the music industry the first half of the year, according to the Recording Industry Association of America.
You can think streaming services like Spotify, which make up almost half of sales.
Well, don't thank them just yet. The economics still haven't quite shaken out. Spotify still hasn't turned a profit, and streaming royalties are almost a loss leader for bands.
Who should we kick a buck to at the end of this segment?
Third Eye Blind?
Ugh.
Last week, we asked you to come to us with your questions about money that you've always wanted to know, but maybe were afraid to ask. We got tons of responses, with questions about everything from retirement to investing and loans to currency and the very nature of money. We're going to take them bit by bit. Sam Kovac Orr is a 25-year-old law student in Philadelphia, and he wrote to us on Facebook. He had a question about the future of money.
I'm curious what the deal with the U.S. continuing to use physical currency is. It's kind of bugged me that a lot of businesses are cash only, and I feel like there would be a lot of benefits to moving to all digital transactions.
You know I'm going to call you a millennial for this, right?
Yeah, for sure.
What kind of transactions do you prefer? Like, how do you like to pay for stuff?
I usually use my debit card if it's available. I haven't really gotten into the cell phone transaction thing unless I'm just sending money to a friend. But yeah, usually debit card.
What bothers you about using cash?
I just never have it. And when I need it and I don't have it, I have to use an ATM with fees. And it just seems like so much work to just buy an item when that should be a very easy transaction to me.
If you could do away with cash, like if you were not even the head of the Fed, but like emperor of all money, what would you do?
I think there are a lot of issues that might come up with access to debit cards. So I think creating like a public banking option, maybe as like a way to get debit cards into the hands of everyone, maybe just getting rid of physical cash and moving toward cell phone and debit card transactions.
Explain that public debit card. That sounds kind of cool.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I wouldn't want to isolate any population by moving to all digital currency. But I think we're having a lot of issues with private banks. And I know a lot of businesses don't like having the digital transaction option because they have to pay money to accept debit cards and credit cards. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there's a clear public interest in having low fee debit cards that maybe the government could step in and handle.
Do you remember the last time you paid cash for something?
Yes. I think I bought gas with cash because they have the higher price for digital transactions.
How would you feel about a happy medium where fees went away maybe for people taking out cash, for businesses processing cards? Would that be better, or is it the physical act of cash itself that bugs you?
I think it's beyond just the issue of getting cash and having to pay money to do it. It also goes into government spending and creating money. I know like the creation of the penny has cost more than it's worth for a while, and it just seems to me like a logical next step with all the technology that we have nowadays.
Another Facebook commenter, Ed Morrill in San Diego, California, had sort of an opposite line of thinking.
I'm wondering, why hasn't the dollar coin ever really caught on? They seem to have released several of them into circulation over the years. They only seem to be used by like transit machines, and that's about it. Why don't people use them?
Do you use them?
I've only used them when I've gotten them as change from like a transit machine, and I've tried to get rid of them as soon as possible. a lot of people don't like to take them and are confused if they're legal tender or not.
Yeah, I mean, they are, and they have been for a while, but you're right. I feel like you pay with one of those, and you get this sort of confused, like, wait, is that Canadian money you're giving me, facial expression?
Exactly. And they're not sure where to put it in their drawer. But having traveled to Europe, I mean, the pound coin and the two-pound coin and the euro coin and the two-euro coin seem to be very, very well used over there.
Yeah, you're right. Although I will say that I have accidentally, you know, left the equivalent of like $10 as a tip because I'm not always great with change money.
Yeah, exactly. And it's when you're paying with a 2 euro coin, that's like $3 US, and the 2 pound coin, it used to be $4 US. And those seem pretty commonplace over here, but we only have dollar bills and they don't have 1 pound notes or 1 euro notes over there.
So what do you think it is that would make people actually want to use the dollar coins instead of looking at them when they come out of a subway machine, you know, with horror or disgust?
I'm honestly not sure. I mean, you go to the bank and you can get dollar coins, no problem. It's just dollar bills seem to be so much more well circulated than dollar coins. I never really know why.
Well, I can tell you this, having once gone to the basement of the Baltimore Fed, where they have these things in huge bags stacked and lying around, one of the things that happened is they introduced the Sacagawea dollar coin without actually taking any paper dollar bills out of circulation. So all things being equal, people still had the choice of the paper dollar as opposed to the coin. So I guess here's a question. If you had a choice, so let's say you buy a coffee from me, right? And I can give you your change. Do you want it in coins or bills?
I want it in bills because nobody accepts the
coins. Aha! All right, we're going to run this by some experts for you. Ed Morrill, thanks so much for calling us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Lizzie.
We are taking a break from this conversation next week to bring you some of our coverage of student loan debt as part of a collaboration with the PBS NewsHour. But we'll have answers to these questions and more in the weeks to come. If you want to submit your own question about money, something you've always wanted to know about, visit marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice could be used on the air. It's been 9 months or so since media around the country and the world was focused on Flint, Michigan, and the lead in its water. When I went to Flint back in January, the city was still in turmoil. The National Guard handed out bottles of water every day, and small children were being tested for lead poisoning at open houses held by the community school district. Now the kids in that district are back in school. And remember, school is where any neurological or behavioral damage from lead might show up first. We called up the superintendent of the Flint school system, Bilal Tawab, to talk about what progress has been made and what hasn't. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So let's say I'm a first grader in the middle of the school day and I want to get a drink of water. What do I do?
Well, good question. We definitely do not want to disturb the learning process. And so we have put in systems or processes that would allow the student to acquire a bottle of water within the classroom. So he or she is able to just get up and as they need water and grab a bottle and go back to their seat and continue with the instruction.
What kinds of things are you seeing in the kids and hearing from them? They've been under stress for so long now.
I would say that right now, I mean, kids are concerned because they're constantly seeing in the news and in the media, you know, hearing about their city and the impact the water may have on their development. So we have had students lift concerns to us, and we've been doing our best to make sure we're addressing those concerns in a very timely manner and ensuring them that we're going to make sure you're okay. As we move forward, because we truly do not know the full impact of the crisis, we have been really focusing on making sure we have a very strong system in place to be able to meet whatever need that may come our way. And so we're really focusing on developing our multi-tiered system of support to be able to meet the needs of all of our kids.
Well, I would imagine part of that is medical support. And when I was there in January, you guys had one nurse for the district.
I would say this, thanks to the state, we have 9 nurses in the district. And also the state has supported us in acquiring additional social workers and speech pathologists and school psychologists. So we're definitely sort of developing the manpower, the human capital that's needed to address the needs of the kids.
I want to try and play a clip from the district nurse back in January because it really stuck with me. I'm going to have our producers play it down the line so you can hear it. Mm-hmm.
Some of the psychologists in the district have said they're the little kids, the 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds that they're testing, that they've already seen a difference.
What are they seeing?
They're not where they should be right now as far as like sociability skills that they test the little ones. This is going to be an ongoing issue for years and years and years. It's a whole generation here that's been poisoned. So the impact on the schools will be huge.
When you deal with the littles and your psychologists and pre-K and kindergarten teachers see them, how do they handle what's happened to them? And how do they separate out what is a child suffering from lead exposure and, a 5-year-old who's hungry?
I would say this. It's really hard for us to, at this time, determine if a child is facing challenges due to the water crisis or some other issue. That's why I feel it's very important that we just be equipped to meet the needs, whatever that need may be, of all of our children.
All of this is expensive.
Yeah.
When we talked in the winter, you told me that you guys had a $10 million budget deficit. How are things looking now?
I would say our deficit is headed in the right direction. This year, our budget is based on 4,700 kids, and to date, we've exceeded that target. And so I'm excited to say that for the district. I will admit we are down 12% in terms of enrollment in comparison to last year. So,
Do you think that's because of the water crisis?
And to be honest, some parents have expressed some concerns this year as it relates to the water. And so I'm sure the water and possibly other issues may have played a part in a parent making a decision to go to another district. So we're moving forward and we're doing great things. And, you know, we have all these resources now coming in. And so we're making sure that we're pushing out that narrative to the community to let them know that we're serious about educating their kids and that we will have the resources to support them moving forward. And so I think that's important now, just making sure our families are informed. This year, we have the huge community education expansion, thanks to the Mott Foundation. And so that allows us to engage the school, the family, and the community in a very meaningful way. And so we're very excited about that opportunity this year.
Obviously, I would imagine one of the other important things here is that you need to hire the best teachers that you can, that these kids need that more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make the pitch to a teacher, come here, come to this under-resourced district where these children are going to be really dependent on a great teacher?
Mm-hmm. I will admit that's a challenge for me right now. And there have been folks who have wanted to come to the district to serve our kids. But unfortunately, due to our current status, our salaries are just not competitive. And so that presents a challenge for someone, husband and wife and children, you know, to be able to raise a family and pay bills on the salaries that we offer. And so as many times as I can, I'm constantly lifting to folks that, you know, either we're going to have to be able to provide a more aggressive salary step system, or we at least need to present some type of incentive program for folks who want to come to Flint to teach, because you're right, our kids deserve the best teachers out there, and those teachers deserve the salaries that they've earned. And so that is my challenge at this point.
You mentioned charitable donations, that the Mott Foundation has given a lot of money to the school system. I think there is a perception out in other parts of America that the federal government and the state sent a lot of money to Flint and things are totally fine now. What would you say to that?
There's still much work to be done. You know, I can speak for sort of my purview. The school district, we're starting to receive resources and that we're very thankful and grateful for those resources. I think there's still additional work to be done on the school level and as the city as a whole.
Do you think that the state is invested in fixing this?
I would say from where I sit in the world of education, the state has been very supportive and at the table. So, yeah, I would keep it at that. I think in the world of education, they have sat down with the district and they're willing to do the work that's needed to be done moving forward.
I am curious about your experience. You came from the Detroit school system. You're a relatively new superintendent. What's it been like walking into this thing?
Oh, yeah, that's been an experience. First year superintendent. You know, the water crisis, it took things to a whole nother level. When I think back, I mean, the second or third week in September, you know, I would have never thought I was going to shut off water in my schools. And I had to make that decision around, I think, about the third week. And then to go through that and begin to put systems in place and dealing with donations and folks coming to me want to know, what's the answer? What are we going to do for the children? Folks see the superintendent as sort of, you know, you're the keeper of children. You're there to protect children. And so what are we going to do? And so just being able to take that all in and begin to immediately collaborate with folks at the city, state, and federal level was really important that first year. And so things have calmed down now. And so now we really are focused on moving forward and really controlling a positive narrative.
When do you think that the schools will stop using bottled water?
That's the million-dollar question. I'm not sure. It's going to require that all stakeholders make that determination. It can't just be made by the schools. So when we get to that point, we're there. But right now, I can't tell you.
Bilal Tawab, superintendent of Flint Community Schools, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
There is something known as the Proust questionnaire. It's a semi-standard Q&A popularized by Marcel Proust about life, values, and personality. We do our own version here with work and money. It's called the Marketplace Quiz. Here's producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's quiz guest.
Hi, I'm Alton Brown. I'm a polyculinary hyphenate.
First question, fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you
everything else that does make you happy. Money buys time. Money buys nice transportation. Money buys everything but love, and sometimes enough things to make up for not having love, like puppies.
In a next life, what would your career be?
A service dog for a very, very rich, lonely woman.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Emptying dishwashers. I hate emptying dishwashers, and I have like 12 of them. And everybody's gone by the time that they're done running, so I have to put everything away. I hate that.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
My second airplane, because it meant selling my first airplane, and I really loved that airplane.
When did you realize working with food could be an actual paying career?
When somebody actually started giving me money to do it. It wasn't until my show Good Eats got picked up by Food Network. It was actually when we got picked up for a second season out of what became a 14-year run. But I really didn't get it until that first pickup after the first 13 episodes.
What is your most prized possession?
Probably a photograph of that first airplane. No, I'll be really honest. I don't have any prized possession.
Not like a really good pan that you trust or spatula or something like that. I assume.
Well,
that's
all just tools. Those are all just tools. I do not get emotionally attached to things. I just don't. I can pick up a thing and I can enjoy it and I can like it, but in the end, it's just a thing, and you either own it, and if you own it, it kind of owns you. So I just don't get that attached.
What was your first job?
My first paying job was a busboy in a barbecue restaurant. I was 14 years old. I got fired later for being underage.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
A decent watch. Because a decent watch you will always look at, and it will always remind you of the one thing that is running out that you can't get back.
Last question. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
Don't sell that first airplane. No, I'm kidding. Don't take advice. Don't take advice from anybody.
Just figure it out as you do it.
Figure it out, man. Figure it out. Because 90% of the advice that people give you is actually them expressing regret or fear.
I'm done with you now, so you can leave.
You've had your way.
That's it. That's all.
I'm sorry if I didn't give more culinary answers. You know, like the one thing that everybody should own is a 10-inch cast iron skillet. I'm just not going to play that.
Alton Brown's latest book, Everyday Cook, is out now. If you sit down with Netflix this weekend and decide to binge on, say, my particular current favorite, Narcos, for example, you're using cloud computing. And that computing is happening in huge data centers built largely in rural America. But despite massive construction, the one thing that new infrastructure for data centers hasn't brought with it? Jobs. Quentin Hardy is the deputy tech editor at the New York Times, and he wrote about data centers. He joins me now from the newsroom. You might hear a few people typing in the background. Quentin, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here.
I want to read a little bit of this story that you wrote. We are talking about a place called Boydton, Virginia. And I'm just going to read this description.
Six unmarked hangars each hold tens of thousands of computer servers. Microsoft has cleared enough scrub trees and vines for at least 15 of these buildings, and six more are already under construction. This is this place, a rural community in Virginia. Tell me about what's going on there.
You are there or what? What that guy, me, is talking about is this phenomenal build-out that isn't being seen by most of the country that's going on among the biggest cloud computing companies, companies like Amazon and Microsoft, to create really an entirely new kind of computing infrastructure around the world, but particularly America. And what they're doing is taking what had been standard computer facilities and taking them up to an enormous scale using what's called cloud computing and certain kinds of software we don't need to get into, but it creates this incredible capability to run supercomputing or cheap computing or really whatever kind of computing you want to mix and match to anyone who's got an internet connection.
So these are sort of the servers where, you know, I take a picture and it gets stored in the cloud. That's where it is actually physically being...
You go to Netflix and browse, that's cloud computing. You call down your songs, that's cloud computing. And what makes this so important economically is that, I mean, think about a dirt road versus a highway. They're both roads, but highways and curved bridges and all the stuff that allowed big trucks and fast cars and then brought on fast food and, you know, container cargo shipments and suburbs and all the other stuff that went with it was really like a different economic framework. It was an infrastructure that changed things. And I think that's what these cloud computing centers are.
But they're a very particular 21st century kind of infrastructure, because if you were around the time of the Industrial Revolution building factories or even later power plants, they brought tens of thousands of jobs with them. What happens here?
Well, this is so interesting because they promise the future that makes many people wary, which is a future of fantastic technology and yet very, very few jobs. And that's what they are. I mean, inside those many, many buildings Microsoft has in just one location, and there are many others, there's maybe 20 or 30 serious workers. By serious, I mean highly paid technical people. And then there are some security people and some groundskeepers. But this is in a town where the factory used to employ 300 people or 500 people. And they're going into the same places. They're going into the Rust Belt, the former industrial America. And they like those sites because there's already railheads or there's fiber or there's electrical. And they can go in there and they create our economic future. They just don't create a lot of jobs.
Yeah, believe it or not, my great-great-grandfather was from Boydton, Virginia, where you wrote about this Microsoft
data center. Really? A tobacco
guy. Yeah, and that was tobacco country a really long time ago. Mm-hmm. When you talk to people in these towns, did they think jobs were coming with these data centers?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, somebody's coming in with hundreds of millions of dollars in economic development. The natural connection is there's going to be lots of work. And as you say, this was tobacco country, and they took that tobacco settlement money and put a big chunk of it into zinc and fiber, thinking that would create industrial development and that will create jobs. And instead, they have brought the future, and it is bringing some tax dollars, and they tell me at the gas station there's an extra lunch table for the construction workers who are there for now, and there are construction jobs for now. But long term, they embody our future, which is fantastic levels of technology, and work is very problematic.
There's another interesting wrinkle in the stories you've been reporting, which is a lot of these companies don't want to be seen as energy hogs. So there's sort of a secondary boon for the green energy industry that comes alongside this development.
And they are not energy hogs. They are just mammoth consumers of energy at a pretty efficient level. And Amazon in particular, but the others, are acutely aware of their public image. I say Amazon because Greenpeace wrote a report a few years ago dinging them for being particularly dirty, and they've made efforts since then to show how green they are. So in a way, you know, the way I said highways created suburbs and fast food and all sorts of things people didn't expect, I think the collective demand from what the tech sector is doing is really changing the economics of alternative energy. It's creating demand that wasn't there before, and so there's going to be a much bigger build, and that'll affect prices.
Quentin Hardy, Deputy Tech Editor of the New York Times, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Stay with tech for this next story. By now, even if you're my mother, you are probably used to interacting with friends and colleagues on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, networks like that. But there are also places on the internet where total strangers can connect and share their passions and form real friendships over things like board games, cats, going through chemotherapy, even discussing economic policy, sometimes without using a real name. It happens on blogging sites like Tumblr and in a big way on Reddit, which is sometimes called the front page of the internet. You can find a group there about pretty much everything. We wanted to look at how those communities form, so we brought in an anthropologist. Her name is Christine Mullenbert, and she works for Reddit as a community manager. I asked her to use her academic background and tell us what makes an online community real.
To me, it's fully authenticity. You know, I've been doing academic work and online community management itself for about 15 years, which makes me feel a little old on the internet. But I have seen so many places try to build community and just not had it happen because there's not an organic feel to it. The community didn't build it. On Reddit, the community just can come in. If there's not a subreddit already for the topic you want, you can create it and build it yourself. You know, we have our own site-wide rules and guidelines that you need to follow, but within those structures, you can build what you want. And so you can talk about the topics that are of interest to you. And because it's organic, because it comes from the users, it grows so much faster and people enjoy it so much more.
Well, how would you explain the difference then between a social network and an online community?
Oh, that's the never-ending question, right? To me, social media, it's a much more curated experience, whereas on Reddit, it's really not a curated experience. The users do it themselves. So instead of us trying to decide what the best content is for someone to see, the users are deciding it themselves. On Reddit, they use the upvote and downvote to decide to say, hey, this is a piece of content I think is great, or hey, I don't think this piece of content is so great. They curate it themselves. It creates to that organic experience, and it makes a community flow and function in a much better way.
I guess that organic nature is also the thing that has caused controversies at Reddit. When you've had people, say, taking creep shots of women and posting them, how do you as a community manager decide what gets your touch and what doesn't?
So we have community rules and policies, and those are the things that as a community manager and as what is known as a Reddit admin, that's my job, is to ensure that those rules and guidelines are enforced. The community has tools as well. The moderators of the specific subreddits can go in and do things on their side to moderate their community. But if it starts getting a little bit larger than they can handle, they bring it to us, and then we can step in and say, no, you don't need to be doing that. And then we can take action with our tools, which are, you know, a little bit larger because they're site-wide instead of just on a subreddit basis.
I have to say my eyebrows went up when one of my producers said, oh, we're going to have this anthropologist from Reddit on. Where does anthropology fit into this?
So the thing that's great about anthropology is we take a much more holistic view of culture. Whereas, you know, some places will, if they want to know what's going on with their community, they might send out a survey or they might bring in people for a focus group. And those are great. Those are great ways to learn about your community. But they don't tell the whole story. That's where I think anthropology comes in, is that we do, it's called participant observation. We go into the cultures and we live with them and we do what they do so that we can see how they actually live and how they actually work. And in applied anthropology, which is what I do, we just take those exact same methods and we apply them to things that, you know, aren't traditional anthropology. We apply them to business. We apply them to online communities. And then we use what we get out of that to further business. This is exactly what I set out to do when I was in school. It absolutely is. I started in online community management in 2000 when it was even more of a niche thing than it is now. And I did the dot-com boom and bust, like everybody did at that point. And after the bust, I went, I want to go back to school. And as I went back to school and I got involved with anthropology again, I realized that I could take anthropology and I could use it to really study and learn about these communities that I loved so much, that I had spent so much time on in the early or in the late 90s.
What draws you to communities that are largely self-made and self-built rather than something that already exists, you know, a Facebook alumni group, for example?
I love the passion of these communities, and I always have. My very first, like, real internet online community was around an online comic strip. We had nothing in common, most of us. We loved this comic strip. And we talked about other things, too. We shared our lives. We shared our dreams. We shared our disappointments. But it was all because we loved this thing, and we were passionate about this thing. And the passion of these communities is what brings me back just over and over and over. I can't get away from them. I love them too much.
How do you turn Reddit from a place you might go every so often to check in on a topic to something that you want to go back to every day and where you feel like you've made real friends?
When you find the people that are passionate about the things that you're passionate about, and you start to kind of get to know them as you visit more and more, you know, when you see the conversations that are happening, when you see that they're talking about the things that you love, and you go, oh, I just heard about this thing that happened. Like, for me, that's the World Cup of Hockey. I want to go find out what people are saying about the World Cup of Hockey. I want to find out what they're talking about, what they think about the game last night. What do they think about the game tomorrow? Because they have the same passion I do, I know that they're going to be excited at the level I'm excited about, and we're going to have a fantastic conversation.
Christine Mollenburn, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we explore the issue of student debt. 42 million Americans hold student debt, about $1.3 trillion of it. How did we amass so much, and can we ever pay it off? It's part of a special reporting project with the PBS NewsHour. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, with help this week from Golda Arthur. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.